Nuclear power, holiday returns, and how the heck do I work this new gadget? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, D.C., I'm Lizzie O'Leary, in for Kai Rizdahl. It is Tuesday, December 27th, and good to have you with us, as always. We are starting the show today with a story about a company that's found itself in a big financial mess. I'm talking about the Japanese industrial conglomerate Toshiba. You might know it's electronics, but it's been getting into the energy business. Toshiba made a big bet on nuclear energy here in this country, one that went pretty sour. The company said today it will take a loss that could run several billion dollars when all is said and done. From the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong gets us going.
Toshiba is the parent company of Westinghouse, which touts a newer, safer nuclear energy reactor. But getting the bugs out has cost billions in cost overruns and multi-year delays in projects in Georgia and South Carolina. Jonathan Hinsey is with a nuclear consulting firm, UX.
There are going to be some learning curve issues, and delays impact the costs. And Westinghouse, as the builder of these projects, is having to take on some of that.
Its parent Toshiba is already reeling from an accounting scandal. But there's a bigger challenge in the U.S. energy market. Nuclear plants are huge, multi-year investments, competing with cheaper, nimbler options like natural gas. They're risky, says energy professor Peter Fox Penner at Boston University.
You could think about it as, are you going to build two or three medium-sized factories over the next 10 years to follow the demand of your customers? Or are you going to take a big bet and build a very large factory?
There could be a silver lining here. Long-term, nuclear power could be a key piece of a low-carbon future globally. To bet on all this, Toshiba has ditched many lower-margin businesses. Japan economist Arthur Alexander, who lectures at Johns Hopkins, applauds the company for trying to do a few things well.
Moving out of their hundreds of operations and focusing more. The other is the openness and transparency in the new management. If both of these succeeds, it could be a good sign for the large old Japan companies.
That is, if Toshiba can survive this mammoth loss. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
There are members of my family, they will remain unnamed, who set out this morning to return some presents. And they're not alone. According to the National Retail Federation, about 10% of all holiday purchases end up getting returned. That number is 30% for online orders. But if you return that sweater your mom got you to a brick-and-mortar store, you might end up buying something else. Marketplace's Andy Uhler says that's exactly what retailers are hoping.
I hope all the economics nerds out there will back me up on this one. Giving presents, even for the holidays, is economically inefficient. Case in point, returns. The National Retail Federation says $65 billion of the $650 billion we spent on gifts this holiday season will come back to retailers. But Jessica Dankert with the Retail Industry Leaders Association says it might not all be bad news for retailers with brick-and-mortar locations.
40-60% of folks who come back into the store to make a return are going to buy something else while they're there, and about a quarter of those will end up spending more than the actual return that they had.
Kit Yarrow is author of Decoding the New Consumer Mind. She says we're apt to spend more because we don't feel as guilty for spending that return money.
We tend to spend both gift cards, which are in our pockets right now this time of year, and also return money a little bit more easily than we do new money or cash, money that we earned.
Retailers are marking things down after the holiday and also bringing out new merchandise while foot traffic is still high. Ellen Davis is Senior Vice President of Research at the National Retail Federation.
So when you're looking at the winners and losers of returns, one important thing to recognize is that if somebody bought something from Macy's online and they're bringing it back to the store, that's the ability for Macy's to convert that purchase.
She says it's not that retailers don't lose money when you return things, but if they can turn that return into a different sale, they might actually come out ahead. I'm Andy Uhler for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, a little bit of a bump. Details when we do the numbers. Labor unions are preparing for big changes ahead of a Trump presidency. The Service Employees International Union, the second largest in the country, is planning significant budget cuts starting next year. They expect so-called right-to-work laws and a changing legal landscape for union-related cases to drastically lower their revenues. SEIU has more than 2 million members. About half of them work in the public sector. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
In an internal memo, the president of the SEIU told staff to plan for a 30% budget cut by 2018. The union is starting with a 10% budget cut beginning in January. It's readying for a tough road with the incoming administration. Kate Bonn is an economist with the left-leaning Center for American Progress.
I think they probably want to build up their reserves. They know some of these big fights they're going to go on are going to be pretty costly in the moment.
One of those fights will be over so-called right-to-work laws. These laws stop unions from demanding all workers at a business or government agency pay dues. With coming Republican control of all three branches of the federal government, these laws are expected to become more common, maybe including a national right-to-work law. Ruth Milkman teaches at the City University of New York.
The income of unions that are representing public sector workers will be threatened severely.
So unions will be fighting for survival with potentially a lot less revenue. Plus, the new Republican administration will fill dozens of open seats in federal courts and pick new members for the National Labor Relations Board. Joseph Slater is a law professor at the University of Toledo.
You're going to get both a more conservative, a more pro-management or anti-union National Labor Relations Board, and you're likely to get a federal judiciary that is also more hostile to labor unions. So it's going to be a tough fight in terms of law and politics for unions in the next 4 years.
And so, he says, it makes sense that the unions are tightening their belts. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
We're going to stay with the incoming administration now. We're still learning a lot about the people President-elect Donald Trump wants in his cabinet. One thing we do know, many of them are quite wealthy. We're talking five billionaires so far and more than a handful of multimillionaires. And that kind of money often makes for complicated businesses and potential conflicts of interests. Conflicts that need to be disclosed before the Senate starts confirmation hearings. And that can mean delays. Marketplace's Rima Crace has our story.
Trump's nominees, well, let's just say they're not typical. For example, Rex Tillerson, head of ExxonMobil. Trump tapped him for Secretary of State. Tillerson still has to be confirmed by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Maryland Senator Ben Cardin leads the Democrats on that panel.
This is the first nominee we've had in a long time that comes strictly from the business sector who has never been vetted for a public position.
Cardin says Tillerson has pledged to turn over his financial records. Still, Senate Democrats are pushing for years of his tax returns, and they want more financial records from all Trump nominees. Jeff Hauser runs the Revolving Door Project, which scrutinizes political appointees.
A lot of these people will have to, if confirmed, divest from financial and fiduciary relationships, which are extremely complicated.
Hauser says normally campaigns start vetting nominees long before Election Day.
Instead, this process is not starting until December.
Democrats have been complaining about the slow pace, and of course they are, says Dan Mitchell of the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank.
A lot of the push for disclosure is political theater. It's what the opposition party does.
And so, he says, expect fireworks in January. Here's another way to think about all of this, says John Hudak, a fellow at the Brookings Institution. You're up for a job, and the boss says, you're hired. But it's not official until you go through HR.
It's like, you know, hiring someone without necessarily checking references or doing, you know, criminal background checks.
He says if nominees aren't vetted well before they're confirmed, Trump's administration risks the chance of something dicey coming out later. That sort of thing has happened in the past, and it is never pretty. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Thanks to the holidays, you may have a new and exciting gadget in your life. And let's be honest, you might not even know exactly what to do with it at this point. How we use all the technology coming at us, whether it's virtual reality, virtual assistants, or our ever-present smartphones, is changing constantly. That's why we got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the line to give us a sense of where we're headed in the new year. Hi, Molly.
Hey, Lizzie.
All right, I need you to look into your crystal ball for me. In 2017, what are the top three tech things that are going to be important for us to think about?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because I feel like the list is different depending on whether you're a consumer or, you know, whether you're talking about the tech industry at large. At large, I think the tech industry, and this will trickle down to consumers, is going to be talking, obviously, about security and encryption. I think we're really going to be talking a lot about voice command as a way to interact with our devices. And of course, this sort of the idea of intelligent things, things that really understand what you want to have happen in your life, that give you contextual information based on when your meetings are or what the weather is like outside. So moving past kind of the simple Internet of Things and talking about using artificial intelligence to make life better. Those aren't things that are going to be immediately apparent in Best Buy, but they're going to be huge kind of technology initiatives that you'll hear a lot about if you cover the industry.
Well, you mentioned security. Obviously, that has dominated a lot of the kind of examination of the 2016 political landscape. Mm-hmm. But if you are a regular old person, you're probably thinking about this now, too. What should you be thinking about in your daily life?
2017 needs to be the year that you stop using the same password on every website, that you get a password manager that can create and store really strong passwords for you that are different on every website. You may even want to download something like the Signal app or an app that does encrypted communication. Yeah, I mean, I think a lot more people are using it because we're now aware of the simple reality that anything that you put in an email, anything you put in a text, in addition to anything you put on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, can become public information in the blink of an eye.
You also mentioned voice commands and this sort of smart things. Who's doing cool voice command stuff right now? And how does that work into our daily lives?
Yeah, so I think that voice as an input is a huge trend for 2017, and it's really interesting. And some of the people doing the smartest work on it are actually at Amazon.
Huh.
They have done phenomenal work with the Echo, as I think, you know, a lot of people now know. It was sort of this surprise hit device that came out of nowhere and really let people know how interesting and easy and fun it is to interact with things using your voice. I think that's going to become a lot more common, and it will be less and less unusual for people to just walk down the street talking to their phones.
Oh, great.
I do it. I confess.
When we think about machine learning and a sort of an intelligent home, I have to admit there's part of this that kind of creeps me out a little bit. Like, do I want my toaster learning exactly how I want a bagel toasted?
Mm-hmm.
The degree to which these things can learn about you, I don't know. Do I want that?
That will be a really big question as this stuff starts to permeate our lives. People even have those questions about voice input and the Amazon Echo and whether it's always listening. You know, what we have seen is a trend toward anticipatory technology. It can anticipate your needs based on what it knows about you, but you have to let it know about you. And that is a concern, and it can feel like it is at odds with saying, hey, you need to lock down all your passwords and lock down your digital information, but turn it all over to Google or Amazon because the data will be useful. But I think that every consumer should know what they're getting into and make that personal decision themselves.
Marketplace's senior tech correspondent, Molly Wood, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Lizzie.
Coming up.
We are indulgent, so we're not trying to shy away from that. So, you know, Louis C.K.'s routine is a little over the top, but we love it.
Why Cinnabon embraces its decadence, even if that makes it the butt of a joke. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points, less than 0.1%, to close at 19,945. The NASDAQ was up 24 points, 0.4%, to finish at 5487. And the S&P 500 increased 5 points, 0.2%, to end at 2268. We talked about Toshiba's woes over its nuclear construction business. It tanked more than 11%. Competitors Hitachi fell off more than 3%. General Electric was essentially unchanged. Over in Europe, Britain's FTSE, France's CAC 40, and Germany's DAX all rose about 0.1%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.56%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is a nonprofit listener-supported service. To keep our coverage strong and relevant, please make a tax-deductible gift to Marketplace today. Donate at marketplace.org by December 31st.
This is Marketplace. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Yes, it looks like the Trans-Pacific Partnership is on its last legs as we head toward a Trump presidency. But Trans-Pacific trade itself is expanding, especially along a rather ancient route. China has started a multi-billion-dollar investment program into the New Silk Road, as it's known. It's a network of rail and road connections through Central Asia that helps connect Chinese factories to European and Middle Eastern markets. The thing is, Beijing still wants U.S. businesses to help complete the project. From our partners at the BBC, Jane O'Brien reports.
China is now trying to resurrect the ancient Silk Road trading route with a rather more prosaically titled One Belt, One Road initiative, a network of railroads, highways, pipelines and ports with an initial Chinese investment of $40 billion.
For Western audiences, this often sounds like a propaganda ploy or a slogan without much meaning.
Yukon Huang is a former World Bank director for China and is now a senior associate at the Carnegie Asia program.
It's actually a strategic, a potentially comprehensive framework that encompasses China's economic and foreign policy intentions in Asia.
While China is prepared to pay for its new Silk Road, it still needs help building it. And for that, it's turning to the U.S. Political relations may be frosty at times and likely to grow colder under a Trump administration, but, says Qichong Fong, chairman of the China International Contractors Association, market forces are often more powerful than politics.
Business is business, and I see profits and see opportunities. Whenever there is the opportunities and also the profits, no company will refuse. And I think Americans companies are the same. I see the great potential opportunities for us to cooperate.
One major U.S. company betting heavily on the Silk Road project is Caterpillar. Tom Paulette is group president of construction at Caterpillar, which remains the world's largest seller of earth-moving equipment.
It is a natural project which we are perfectly positioned to help with. And of course, we've been active in China for 40 years, so we celebrated 40 years last year. This will be our fourth year of successive top-line decline. Part of that decline has been the Chinese economy, which is one of the top construction markets in the world, and it's down 70 or 80% from the peak, but it remains a very, very important market for us.
One of the Silk Road nations that stands to benefit from China's massive infrastructure investment is Georgia. It has free trade agreements with China and Europe and sees economic improvement as the best way to strengthen democracy in a turbulent region. But Georgia's special envoy to the U.S., Grigory Tsakolia, says U.S. commercial involvement is essential to counter Russian and Chinese expansion.
This is the reason why we are so happy to see that the largest infrastructural development that is taking place currently on the coast of the Black Sea, the development of the deep sea port, is done by the consortium of the companies that include U.S. companies.
As long as China doesn't grow weary of investing abroad while growth slows at home, many U.S. businesses see great opportunity in the Silk Road project. But Caterpillar's Tom Paulette says they'd better be quick.
The train is leaving the station. There's many, many projects that have already been funded. By the time everything's said and done, whether it's 30 years or 40 years from now, it will be the biggest undertaking by mankind when you look at all the infrastructure that will go into place.
Success will depend on a number of factors, though: regional security, cooperation, and of course the markets themselves. And China still needs to convince some Silk Road nations and investors that the benefits will be widely spread.
That's Jane O'Brien from the BBC. If you travel through an airport this holiday season, there's a good chance you didn't see a Cinnabon. It seems weird, right? I associate the chain, which makes those gooey cinnamon rolls, with layovers. But it turns out the company has only 16 airport locations now. That's down from about 160 a decade ago. Cinnabon is much more focused on changing up its stores to look like French bakeries, making a play on social media to attract millennials, and expanding into China. Joe Guth is president of Cinnabon, and he's in charge of this whole reinvention. Thanks for coming on.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
You know, brand is one of those really overused corporate buzzwords, but without it and a strong sense of it, a lot of companies fail. What is your brand?
Cinnabon is about over-the-top awesome indulgence in the most simple way in terms of having the world's best cinnamon roll. That is the premise of how this concept was started. It is what we stay to today. And so by continuing to expand that, that's what has allowed us to become a billion-dollar brand and candidly be a brand that's synonymous with the category of cinnamon rolls.
Yeah, I mean, there's a flip side to this idea of indulgence, though, which I'm sure you know. There's a whole Louis C.K. routine about self-loathing and having a Cinnabon. How do you sort of say, like, yeah, we're indulgent, but wait, also, we've redesigned our stores to look more like a French patisserie?
Well, and a testament to the brand is we embrace who we are. We don't shy away from it. We are indulgent, so we're not trying to shy away from that. So, you know, Louis C.K.'s routine is a little over the top, but we love it. And that's what
really
allows us to travel. Yeah, absolutely. The notion of having an undying love for the brand, we absolutely embrace that. And that's what allows us to travel into different formats because we roll with it.
Why are you doing such a big push into China? One of your partner brands, Auntie Anne's Pretzels, had a really kind of bumpy ride in the beginning in China.
If you're in the world of consumer goods or food and beverage, you can't not be in China if you're a global brand. I worked previously with Coca-Cola and Yum Brands, and specifically on KFC. And both those brands, their portfolios, how they present themselves, are dramatically different from where they are in the United States. So it's obviously important to us as it is to the global economy. And cracking the code there is going to be incredibly important as we continue to grow as a global organization.
So how do you position yourself in China then?
There's definitely a strong demand for Western brands, but the palate of the Chinese consumer is ever evolving. Coffee was not necessarily top of the list for beverage selections in China, and yet Starbucks is projecting that China will be larger than their U.S. business. So I think we've got to figure out what we look like there. The Chinese palate is generally from a dessert or a sweet standpoint, not as sweet as our current profile. So those are the kinds of things that we'll have to consider as we move forward and try to penetrate the Chinese market.
Here in the U.S., there has been a lot of movement in the food service industry around minimum wages. Where do you stand on, say, the fight for 15?
Well, I think what matters is we are in a capitalistic economy. And so for any concept or business to work, it has to generate returns for people who are the investors in that business. And in our case, these are franchisees who are investing their personal capital. And so therefore, at this point, just taking us from where we are today in minimum wage to $15 an hour overnight would be catastrophic to our business. Hmm. Over time, as we evolve, as the economy grows, I think that's where we have to keep that in mind. And as long as we stay in line with market prices and delivering superior returns, then obviously we always want our team members to be fairly paid. So I think it's a balance.
I look at a lot of the things you guys have done, and it feels to my eyes like you are targeting millennials. You know, the iPad point of sale systems and co-branding with Better Call Saul and all of these things. Is that who you're going after? Is that the demographic you want?
Absolutely. They are going to be representing the largest portion of the economy in terms of economic power over the next 3 to 5 years. There is this interesting duality in that they are also the people who come work for us by and large. So we do zero paid media. Everything we do is in PR, social, and digital. So everything with Better Call Saul to posts and engagement that we do on Facebook, as well as our launch on Snapchat, are absolutely targeted at millennials.
Joe Guth, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
this final note before we go, and this is a bit of a host prerogative. You may have heard that actor, author, and screenwriter Carrie Fisher died today at age 60. Like many little girls in the 80s, I loved Princess Leia. She was cool and tough. She didn't always need a boy to save her. But now, as an adult woman, it is Fisher's remarkable body of work that I want to salute. She was, of course, an actor, but she also wrote 3 memoirs, 4 novels. She mined her own messy life for the painful and hilarious Postcards from the Edge. She was also a highly sought-after script doctor in Hollywood. She's said to have punched up the screenplays for the likes of Hook, Sister Act, The Wedding Singer, and apparently the Star Wars prequels. That is a hell of a legacy. And yeah, I'm going to say it. Carrie Fisher, may the force be with you. Always. Today, the Dow gained 11 points, less than 0.1%. The NASDAQ was up 24 points, 0.4%. And the S&P 500 increased 5 points, 0.2%. Tommy Andres and Raghu Manavalan are producers on our elections desk. Caitlin Ash is our producer on the wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Nishat Kurwa, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. We'll see you all tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.